Hello everyone and welcome to this new session of Mempcast. My name is Christina Kushu and I'm one of the Leicester Renal Registrars and also one of your MEMcast hosts. And today I'm back for another session related to chronic kidney disease. I will speak to you about the progression to end-stage renal failure or end-stage renal disease. We had a few podcasts looking into different aspects of CKD, which you can still listen to our platforms. And we've also had some podcasts related to different types of renal replacement therapy, like hemodialysis. We're going to focus on the patients that are due to progress to end-stage renal failure or have progressed to end-stage renal failure, about their management, and how are they monitored in the community, and also the multidisciplinary team that looks after them. We're also going to touch a bit about renal replacement therapy methods. So let's get started. The reason for this podcast is to give you an idea of what you should be looking out for and what are you going to focus on when you are seeing this type of patients that have reached end-stage renal failure during your own calls. In our previous podcast on CKD, we spoke about CKD stages, so I'm not going to touch on that. Just a reminder, patients with an eGFR of below 30 have significant impairment of their kidney function. These patients will be assessed often through a combination of patient-clinician appointments and or blood tests, roughly on a 3 to 4 monthly basis. And the frequency of the review in outpatients will be determined by factors such as the rate of progression of kidney disease, the patient's comorbidities, the severity of the renal impairment, and also presence of associated complications of CKD. Patients with an eGFR of below 15, so patients that are CKD stage 5, that either are dialysis independent or who require some form of dialysis, are referred to as end-stage renal failure. This CKD stage represents patients with the lowest level of kidney function. In basic terms, end-stage renal failure refers to patients who have insufficient kidney function to keep them feeling well and who might benefit from treatments which take on some of the functions of the kidney, such as dialysis, which we're going to speak about later, or a transplant. As you can see, apart from numbers, this is based on patient symptoms as well. And these patients are monitored in a different clinic than the general nephrology clinics. So these type of patients, either CKD4 or patients with end-stage renal failure, mostly CKD4 that are expected to progress quickly to end-stage renal failure or have comorbidities or complications of CKD that need frequent monitoring, are seen in a pre-dialysis clinic. Also, sometimes a pre-dialysis clinic is termed as a low-clearance clinic or an advanced kidney care clinic. This is so that they can be monitored more frequently, have blood tests more frequently, and have their symptoms assessed to see when they actually need to start renal replacement therapy. And also, and most importantly, to prepare them properly to start renal replacement therapy, as depending on methods, this can take a long time. And we'll speak about it later. To give you an idea of a pre-dialysis clinic, they are usually big clinics with multiple consultant nephrologists and or registrars that work alongside a specialist team of experienced renal nurses, renal dietitians, renal pharmacists, and if available, social worker and psychologists. The specialist renal nurses are irreplaceable and play a major role in discussing renal replacement therapy with patients. They go to their house in the community and discuss different types of renal replacement therapy options so that the patient makes an informed decision alongside their consultant nephrologist to assess what would be the best option for them. So it's important to know that these patients are followed up frequently, and they also get, in some cases, for home therapies, social workers and renal specialist nurses go to their house and assess their living conditions. And also they get training on different renal replacement therapy options, which we're going to speak about later. Other valued members of the NDT, pharmacists and dietitians, play an important role in keeping the patient's health and well-being as a priority. Recommending and adjusting different medications doses, and talking to patients about their diet and adjusting to the new changes that bring a huge amount of restriction, fluid-wise and also diet-wise, with low potassium diets and fluid restriction. Okay, so moving on now to give you an idea of the symptoms that patients that have reached end-stage renal failure might encounter. It is important to point out that symptoms of chronic kidney disease will only develop once glomerular filtration rate drops below 30 ml per minute per meter square, so around CKD stage 4. And severe symptoms will only generally appear at an eGFR of below 15. So chronic kidney disease doesn't cause symptoms in early stages unless they have an underlying condition that causes their chronic kidney disease. They would get symptoms from that certain condition, like vasculitis, for example. Patients actually come for regular blood tests and they're found to have a low renal function that they've unknowingly had for quite some time. Symptoms of end-stage renal failure are generated by uremia that can affect virtually any organ. So we're going to speak about each system and how uremia might affect it. So our GI system, our gastrointestinal system, patients get significant symptoms like anorexia and nausea or vomiting. In consequence, they lose a lot of weight. They might also have diarrhea and an altered taste. Food might not taste the way it used to. And they become malnourished, which is a huge, huge problem. Moving on to cardiorespiratory symptoms, also a very important aspect of end-stage renal failure. So when we see these patients in pre-dialysis clinic, we do ask them if they're developing breathlessness or shortness of breath. And we do look for signs of fluid overload like leg edema and crackles in the chest on auscultation. Also very important to note that in pre-end-stage renal failure stages, as we've spoken before, blood pressure control is very important, and also an uncontrolled high blood pressure, or on the contrary, a very low blood pressure is a sign of concern. From the cardiovascular system point of view, in extreme cases, you can listen to a pericardial rub for patients that develop uremic pericarditis, which is very rare these days, and I'm going to touch about it later. Moving on to CNS and neurological symptoms. So these might vary significantly from paresthesia to restless legs, insomnia, and in extreme cases, seizures and coma when the patients develop uremic encephalopathy. From an endocrine system point of view, patients are often affected, male patients by erectile dysfunction, female patients by amenorrhea and impaired fertility. Significant problems that are more often than not as discussed by patients or clinicians. Also to note, end-stage renal failure can cause skin changes as well. A very common sign of uremia is uremic pruritus, so extreme itchiness, which is very difficult to manage. We try with topical agents like emollients, but there's a lot of research that's put into it and ongoing, different agents are tested. Last but not least, we've spoken about chronic kidney disease associated anemia. And we touched about symptoms, including tiredness and lethargy in our previous podcast. Also, we mentioned platelet dysfunction that can cause easy bleeding and bruising, which again, it's a problem related to uremia. To note, extreme symptoms like seizures and uremic pericarditis that I've mentioned are very rare, given that this patient should be closely monitored in pre-dialysis clinic, and renal replacement therapy is usually initiated before the symptoms can occur. But these symptoms can appear in what we call crash landers, so patients that come in not knowing that they've had a low renal function for a long period of time. They have blood tests that show a very low kidney function, and they can develop this type of symptoms that would indicate that they need dialysis very soon as an emergency. Okay, moving on to indications for dialysis. So you know about indications for dialysis and acute kidney injury. Most of the indications for dialysis for long-term CKD patients that progress to end-stage renal failure are quite similar. So the first one, fluid overload with salt and water retention, including in extreme cases pulmonary edema. The second one, you know, from medical school, severe refractory acidosis in this type of patients. They might have mild acidosis for a long period of time that's managed with oral sodium bicarbonate or other agents, but they develop severe acidosis that requires them to start formal renal replacement therapy soon. Also, persistent hyperkalemia is another indication for dialysis. And as I spoke about before, uremic pericarditis or uremic encephalopathy represents an acute need for patients to start renal replacement therapy, which in these cases would be hemodialysis is the quickest to arrange. Apart from these indications that might be quite familiar for you from previous talks on acute kidney injury and need for renal replacement therapy, in long-term CKD patients that have progressed to end-stage renal failure and are seen in low clearance clinic or the pre-dialysis clinic, uncontrolled uremic symptoms like pruritus and vomiting, causing weight loss and failure to thrive, and affecting patients' overall well-being and quality of life, will be a trigger to start renal replacement therapy. There is no consensus about the eGFR threshold for starting renal replacement therapy. It is usually below 10, but can be at higher numbers for symptomatic patients. Now, patients in pre-dialysis clinics are prepared to start renal replacement therapy weeks to months, but preferably months before they start, as it's not as a short process as you might think when you see patients started in an acute setting. If these chronic patients that are seen in a pre-dialysis clinic, there's a long length of time between them deciding what type of renal replacement therapy they want and when they start their renal replacement therapy, depending on multiple factors, patient-related factors, and socioeconomic factors. This process can be, in best cases, weeks, but that's rare, or months. Okay, so the modalities of renal replacement therapy are hemodialysis, peritoneal dialysis, and renal transplant. And we're going to speak about them briefly. So hemodialysis, in order to start it, you need vascular access via central line or an AV fistula or a graft. We discussed hemodialysis in details in other podcasts, so I'm not dwell too much on it. It's important to know for patients that you see that have a low renal function in your day-to-day practice, that vein preservation and trying to minimize the use of their veins above the wrist for the formation of an AV fistula is extremely important. AV fistulas remain the gold standard when it comes to starting someone on hemodialysis that are in a pre-dialysis clinic. And also remember that patients that are seen in low clearance clinic might have a preformed AV fistula that is still not in use, because it takes in theory at least 6 weeks to mature, but in practice the process can take months. And these type of patients that haven't started dialysis but have a fistula formed might not be used to telling their medical professionals about their AV fistula, which if not mature might not be as visible is you might be used to seeing very aneurysmal fistulas that are usually quite old, and the patients are experienced hemodialysis patients that would be able to tell the nurses, and also it's quite obvious that they have a fistula, so it's easier to avoid it. But in the case of low clearance patients with fistula that was formed, let's say, a couple of weeks ago and is not in use, they might not be as used to telling you to avoid that area, although they're always told about it. So please, if you see pre-dialysis patient in AMU or somewhere else, just make sure that you're not missing an AV fistula. So look for scars at the wrist or elbow, and also listen for a breath or thrill where the fistula is, and avoid with all circumstances, if possible, to take bloods from the AV arm or to check blood pressure in that arm. Okay, with regards to hemodialysis, patients need to come in 3 times a week for 4 hours for their hemodialysis sessions, but also there is an option for home hemodialysis in suitable candidates. Of note, hepatitis B vaccination is needed in patients that opt for hemodialysis in their pre-dialysis clinics, and that needs to be arranged as soon as possible after they decide on this form of renal replacement therapy. Moving on to peritoneal dialysis. Peritoneal dialysis is a home therapy. This type of renal replacement therapy uses catheter that's inserted into the peritoneal cavity for the fluid to be infused, and solids diffuse slowly across the membrane, getting rid of the waste products. In this type of therapy, the peritoneum is used as a semi-permeable membrane. There are 2 main types of peritoneal dialysis: CAPD, or continuous ambulatory peritoneal dialysis, when patients do manual exchanges at home during the day, or APD, or automated peritoneal dialysis, where patients are connected to a machine that does these fluid exchanges whilst they are asleep. Fluid infused consists of a solution of electrolytes, a buffer to correct the metabolic acidosis, which is usually lactate or bicarbonate, or a combination of both, and an osmotic agent to get rid of the extra fluid or achieve what we call UF, or ultrafiltration. This type of osmotic agent is either glucose or icodextrin. To prepare suitable candidates for peritoneal dialysis, a catheter can be inserted by either a physician or a surgeon, and usually needs resting for 2 weeks to avoid leaks around the catheter post-procedure. Suitable candidates are usually the patients that can do the therapy after they have training from the specialist nurses by themselves, or patients that have a supportive family that can actually be trained and do this process for them. Also, there is a possibility for assisted APD, where a technician comes daily to set up the automated peritoneal dialysis machine. It's important to note that peritoneal dialysis patients usually have residual function, so that means that most of them still pass a good amount of urine, but as we mentioned in the beginning, the renal function that they have is not enough to keep them well and supplied to their needs. Okay, both hemodialysis and peritoneal dialysis can have an incremental start, so fewer sessions to begin with, but gradually increased. But that's for the renal physicians to decide and discuss with the patients. Okay, lastly, with regards to renal replacement therapy, some people don't realize that the transplant is actually a form of renal replacement therapy, so it's not a cure for chronic kidney disease, but it's the best type of renal replacement therapy that patients can get if they're fit to have major surgery and a transplant. A preemptive transplant is a possibility. Preemptive transplant is for patients that haven't needed renal replacement therapy up until now. Why is kidney transplant not a cure of chronic kidney disease? Is the fact that patients still need treatment in the form of immunosuppressants for the rest of their life, and they're also still seen in the kidney clinics, but they move on to being seen in the transplant clinic instead of CKD or pre-dialysis clinics. Also, to end of the podcast, I want to touch on what we call conservative management. So you might come across patients that have a low kidney function for a long period of time, but when you speak to the renal team or when you look into the clinic letters, you see that renal replacement therapy options have been discussed, and it's been agreed that a conservative management would be best for this type of patients. These patients are usually too frail or too unwell from other comorbidities like heart failure, and putting them on a form of renal replacement therapy wouldn't benefit them or might even cause harm. It is important to note that dialysis in general does not prolong life, and that renal replacement therapy like hemodialysis is an intense form of therapy that puts a strain on the patient's cardiovascular system during each session. Also, some patients might choose conservative management as they think that a form of renal replacement therapy would interfere with their quality of life, as it needs huge adjustments. If we spoke about hemodialysis and peritoneal dialysis, they are therapies that need to be done on a regular basis. Hemodialysis 3 times a week in the dialysis unit, staying there for the session and afterwards, waiting transport or getting themselves back home. And peritoneal dialysis most of the time every day at home. So some patients might just choose not to have any form of renal replacement therapy, and it's their right to choose what they think is best for them after having a conversation with their renal specialist and the MDT. It's important to know that conservative management does not mean being discharged from the pre-dialysis clinic. These patients are usually followed up and given support from the renal MDT, and they do get management for their symptoms like agents for pruritus, advice on diet and medication, and fluid balance. Also, some patients might have palliative care input if approaching end of life, and it's difficult to give a specific time frame of prognosis for some patients, as there are elderly patients that have a slow progression of their CKD and are seen in the low clearance clinic for months to years. Now, some take-home messages that I hope you guys are going to be left with, and thank you for joining us for this talk today. The first point that I want to make is that if you see a patient with low renal function, please make sure that they are under follow-up by the renal team, and also discuss inpatient management with the renal team if you have any concerns about clinical management or if you think they have reached the point of needing dialysis. Second point I want to make is that planning renal replacement therapy takes time and does require an MDT approach. Crash landers or patients that need to start dialysis as an emergency in hospital tend to have a worse prognosis given medical and socioeconomic factors with regards to compliance and access to care. So it's important that patients with a low renal function are seen by the appropriate team, and they can get support and they can be prepared properly for starting renal replacement therapy. Finally, as I said, I hope this podcast was useful as a quick tour into the management of patients that have reached end-stage renal failure. Remember, it is not all about the numbers, and all patients are different. And as a physician, we should keep the patient's wishes and concerns as our top priority. So thank you for joining us today, and join us again next week for a new episode.